Hi, readers. Welcome to Books Connect Us from Penguin Random House. This is a podcast about staying connected with each other and the stories and authors who inspire us. Alicia Garza is an organizer, political strategist, and cheeseburger enthusiast. She is the principal at the Black Futures Lab and co-creator of hashtag Black Lives Matter and the Black Lives Matter Global Network. Her book, The Purpose of Power, is an essential guide to building transformative movements to address the challenges of our time. This is the story of one woman's lessons through the years of bringing people together to create change. Now let's join Taylor Knoll in conversation with author Alicia Garza.
Hi, everyone. My name is Taylor, and I work in marketing here at Random House. Today, we have a writer's routine series for you, and I'm going to be joined by special guest Alicia Garza.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Alicia. I have to tell you, I finished the audiobook for Purpose of Power late last night, and I loved the read. It's such an incredible book.
Awesome. Thank you. That makes me really happy. Thank you for that.
It is an honor to be here with you today. And to get us started, do you want to tell our followers a little bit about your new book?
Sure. So, excuse my puppy in the background. My new book is called The Purpose of Power, How We Come Together When We Fall Apart. And it really is a toolkit and a roadmap, both for people who have been fighting for social justice for a while now, and also for people who are just starting out and trying to figure out which way to go. This book is a compilation of lessons that I'm learning, unlearning, and have learned, I would say, from more than 20 years of organizing inside of the Black Lives Matter movement, but also having been an organizer for the last 20 years. So there's so much that people see online about movements, right? And the most visible manifestation of movements, I think, is probably protests. But what I wanted to do with this book was like pull back the curtains and give people a better sense of what's happening offline and really how change actually happens.
But Alicia, at what point did you know that you wanted to tell your story in a book, and you know, also a story of organizers in a book? And how did you find the time to do that?
That is the number one question that people ask me. How do you have the time to do that? And I mean, I wish every organizer in this movement had an opportunity to step back and to write and reflect and analyze and really get a sense of how, take stock of how far we've come and maybe how far we have left to go. I was not able to stop what I was doing per se. I mean, certainly I'm fortunate enough to write the first words of this book at Hedgebrook Writing Retreat, which was excellent. But I was writing and working and organizing all at the same time most days. So it felt important to me, knowing that we were going into one of the most important election cycles in a generation, that we do some summation of the last decade and give ourselves a compass for what options we have for where we're headed from here. Mm-hmm. And those options really are about either putting less power into the hands of less people or putting more power into the hands of more people. And I don't know about you, but given everything that's happening, given all the kind of chaos and misery that's happening in this country and around the world, I think we need to have more power in the hands of more people. And that's what movements do. They put more power into the hands of more people. So what I'm offering here is a sense of how to strengthen our movements so that we can be successful in that goal. And I really hope y'all enjoy it.
Yeah, you write a lot about what power even is, power versus empowerment, and who has each of those things and kind of what use they each offer. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you consider those different and kind of in tandem together also?
Yeah, well, I mean, power, I think, is so contested. And I talk about that a lot in the book, that Oftentimes we confuse power with empowerment and self-esteem. And empowerment and self-esteem is great. Trust me. Like I said in the book, I put my stickies on my mirror and tell myself I'm amazing. But that doesn't change the rules that are rigged against our communities and have been for generations. And so really power, as I define it in the book, is fundamentally about the ability to change the rules and make the rules. And I also talk about how power is the ability to shape the story of who we are and who we can be together. I quote my friend Rashad Robinson from Color of Change, who we did an awesome event with last night for Politics and Prose. And he always says, and I sit with this a lot, right? And I also use this as a metric for my own organizing and campaigns, that if people aren't afraid to disappoint you, then you don't have power. And what we know, for example, about Black communities in this country is that nobody is afraid to disappoint Black people. And so we have to build our movements in such a way where people are afraid to disappoint us, right? And that means, you know, worried that they will lose their position representing us, worried that they will lose money, right? Like, these are all of the different ways in which you can exercise power in order to change the rules. So, and in order to make the rules. And I also talk in the book about the work that I've been doing for the last few years now to, my puppy is going crazy in here. Pandemic puppy, book launch, why not? So I also talk in the book about the work that I'm doing right now to change the balance of power, but also to change how power operates. Mm-hmm. And that's the work that I do at the Black Futures Lab and the Black to the Future Action Fund, where we build our community's capacity to have the tools we need, not just to like tinker around the edges, but also to create the new structures that we need for power to be distributed more equally. So I think what you'll get from this book is stories about what power looks like, how power operates, and also where power is weak. And I talk a lot about, you know, this powerful movement that has shaped my life and your life and really all of our lives, but they are not invincible. And so I talk a little bit about some of our opportunities to build power and get more power into the hands of more people.
Definitely. Alicia, something that I was really struck by in your book was actually the structuring of it, which is sort of a technical question, but I thought it was really interesting how you broke the book up into three separate parts. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what those parts are and kind of why you structure the book in this way?
Yeah, well, this is actually how I think about strategy, and it's how I also think about campaigns. And so it's really like an organizing method. Yes. And it's the way I know how to write. But I think that the first part of the book is really context. You get to know a little bit more about me and how I got here, how I started to get involved in organizing and activism. But I wanted to also tell the story of how the conservative movement has built power over time and how that shaped my life. And I didn't want to do it in like the academic-y way, like no shade to academics. I also, you know, teach at universities and all that stuff. I love academics. And also that doesn't always make for like the most juicy, meaty thing to read, especially right before an election. So it felt important to me, and always it does, right? Even when I teach my students about this movement, I want folks to place themselves inside of it so that we don't see it as something separate from us. This movement has shaped how we see the world, whether we know it or not. I talked about how, for example, growing up in the 80s, I was smack in the middle of the culture wars, but I didn't know at 8 that I was in the middle of a culture war, right? But knowing that MTV News, for example, shaped my understanding of what was happening around me, it shaped my politics, it shaped how I thought about who was deserving and who was responsible for keeping needed things away from people who needed them. That was a culture war with the conservative right that was building power at that time. At that time, that was the rise of the moral majority. It was the rise of, you know, Christian family values being inserted into government. It was the rise of, evangelicals, right? Getting active in politics and organizing. And that meant something for how my life was laid out. It meant something about how my family had access to economic security. It meant something for my single mom who worked three jobs before she met my stepdad and got married. It meant something to me as a young Black child in a school district that didn't necessarily value Black children. And it meant something to the folks around me, right? And so I use that first part of the book to really tell the story of how we got here. Because I think without understanding this clash, right, of movements that are right. actually fighting for different goals, right, but also fighting for hearts and minds, it's hard to understand where we are now. The second part of the book, I really talk about what people have come to understand as the Black Lives Matter movement, right. which frankly is a really wide net that folks have cast for a very long time. And I could get into all the specifics of it. I do some of that in the book. But there are many different entities that make up this movement, some of which are organizations and some of which are not. But I talk a little bit about the period between 2012 mm-hmm. and 2016, basically, so that you get an inside view from somebody like me who was kind of at the center of a lot of these chaotic dynamics and also very beautiful ones. And you get an insider's perspective. There's been so much talked about us that we actually never participated in those stories. So it was a good opportunity to say, okay, here's my perspective from my position and my vantage point. But I also make the point in the book that I actually hope there's a whole canon of Black Lives Matter literature from people who are doing the organizing, because it's important to understand the breadth and the depth of how this movement operates. And my story is not the only story, and it's not the definitive one. It's mine, and it's unique because it's mine, but not because right. I'm the like end all be all of it. And then the last part of the book really is about lessons. And I really do take some of the lessons, not just from the Black Lives Matter movement, but from organizing since the 1990s.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm gonna go do a mask after this, make sure I keep it cute. But these lessons, I think, are things that I'm very deliberate about having learned, things that I'm unlearning, things that I want to challenge, things where I'm challenging myself around stuff. Like, I think the platforms and profiles and pedestals chapter, pedestals, platforms, and profiles, I think is how it's yeah. named, is a really good example of how I place myself inside my own critique. And I talk about how, you know, movements are not built online. They're not sustained online. Movements are talked about online, right? And people learn about movements online. But really, the real exciting and sustaining work happens offline. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there are figures like myself that get cast as like the central figures, right? Because of a lot of reasons. But I actually talk in the book about why that's problematic and why we need to be careful of celebritizing activists, why we need to be careful of assuming that followers are the same thing as a base. And why we need to be careful of assuming that just because you have a million followers on Twitter, that that means you can win an election cycle. That kind of magical thinking really impacts the way that we understand how we make change. And it has severe consequences for the timeline upon which we are able to make the changes that we need.
Yeah, I found that chapter, that section really very interesting. You know, and I mean, that you wrote about how movements are not started by hashtags, they're started by people was really, I mean, it seems obvious, but it isn't. And especially in this moment when we're all kind of stuck at home and the virtual platform might be all that we have available.
That's right.
So I really enjoyed that part of the book a lot. And we have so many great questions here. So I want to get to some of those. So it's not just me talking. We have a question here that asks, What are some of the biggest lessons that you've learned about activism and organizing?
One of the biggest lessons I've learned, and I do talk a little bit about this in the book. In fact, I think I end the book here. I have had to learn how to fight cynicism as an organizer. I kind of came into this work from different perspectives, but one perspective that I feel like I sat in for a very long time was the perspective of just everything that's bad has to be dismantled, which I still have. I still feel that. Everything that doesn't build the dignity and thriving of people should go. But I realized along the way that that wasn't enough for me, that actually I needed to really muster and summons a hope for and a deep belief that things can change and will change, and stick that inside of a vision to start actually parsing out, well, what does the new way look like? And so I would say that my biggest lesson has been, you know, people are not moved by cynicism and despair. They're moved by hope and vision and clarity. And for me, I think one of my biggest lessons is, if I'm fighting for my vision, then I'm fighting for us to still be together in the way that we are, right? And so, yeah, that's what I would offer today.
That's a really powerful sentiment, I think. We have another great question here that says, how have your views evolved and your approach to Black Lives Matter changed over the past couple of months?
How my views, if they, you know, yeah, I mean, I'm gonna say that what I love about this movement is that it's learning lessons in real time and it's trying new things in real time. This year, for the first time, this movement introduced the BREATHE Act, which is literally like this generation's version of the Civil Rights Act. That's huge. That was not possible 7 years ago, and people would not have been thinking about it like that. So I feel like the other part of why this isn't a BLM story is because the movement for Black Lives and this movement and the Black Lives Matter, the story is still being written. We are far from finished. In fact, I feel like we're just getting started. So I don't know if I'm changing in any way as much as I'm focusing. And for me, I am focused on political power. I'm focused on building Black political power. I'm focused on changing rules, and I'm focused on making sure that our people know how to do that.
Yeah, great answer. Another question, there's so many great questions. I'm gonna try to get to as many as I can in the next few minutes here. This question reads, what was the hardest part of the writing process or your favorite part of the writing process?
Oh, okay, I'll do both. My favorite part of the writing process, these are both related to my mom, actually. My favorite part of the writing process was I went out to Hedgebrook. I got invited to come and reflect. I got invited for some radical hospitality and to write. And I have written lots of things, but I don't think I considered myself to be a writer. So here I am in this cabin, like in the woods on an island, you know, and I'm like, huh. Just hear with the sound of the trees. I have no idea what I'm gonna write. So I call my mom. Call my mom to chitty chat, and I'm sitting at the little window seat. And we actually talked about a story that I felt like I'd never super been clear on. And for some reason that day, she was being so honest and open. My mom's like really blunt, but she was also private. It was like kind of like shit you need to know if she wanted you to know it, you know? But she told me the story actually of, she told me the story of like the time she left, from the time she left home when she graduated from high school all the way up until she had me. And I'd heard pieces of the story, but not in this level of detail. And there was a lot of things that I learned, and I feel like there was a lot of things that got healed for me. And that day, after we got off the phone, I think we talked for like 3 hours, I wrote for probably about 8 or 9 hours straight. there was like a lot of stuff that came out. So I remember being up at like 3 in the morning with my snacks and like my music, and you can blast your music because you know your cabins are far from each other.
Yeah.
So it was excellent. And getting to sleep in the next day was also dope. That was my favorite part of the writing process. The worst part of the writing process for me, I'm gonna say it's two things. One was when my mom passed away, like really unexpectedly. I wasn't finished with my draft, it was due. And also my whole world, like, yeah, my whole world went up in flames, and I was like really terrified that I wasn't gonna finish. I had no motivation to write, I had no motivation to finish, I had no motivation to think about the project. And then I started getting all this anxiety about like, I made this commitment, you know, I don't think I wanna write this anymore. I need to like focus on something else, but I didn't know what that was. And I feel like it was just grief and I had to just be in that. And it made writing hard. You know, reading the things that I had written about my mom that were now past tense in a different way was really hard. And at the same time, it unlocked some stuff in me that I think had that not been there, the book would not be what it is. So it was the hardest part, but I don't know if it was like the worst part. Sure. It just was hard.
Yeah. Well, I'm so sorry for your loss. I really did enjoy all the scenes about you and your mom and your relationship in the book.
Thank you.
And I'm so impressed by how you balanced the personal with the historical and the analytical in this book. And all this like seamless narrative fashion. It's incredible. How did you accomplish that?
It's literally how I've learned to tell stories. And I was so honored when Kiese Lehmann said that he thought that this could be a new genre, right? Like, I was like, wow, that's a big deal coming from him. He's amazing. He's like my favorite writer. So it's the way that I think about things. So for me, it's like context, place yourself in it. And then it's like draw conclusions. And then it's like, okay, so what does that mean for what we're doing? What does that mean for what we need to do? This is how I think about my campaigns, my organizing. It's how I tell stories. I mean, you could ask my partner, they probably get sick of it because they're like asking me a very basic question. I'm like, well, to understand the answer to that, I got to take you right back. And then now I'm going to place us in this context. He's like, I just want to know where the muffin pan is, you know.
Yeah.
that's it's just how I tell stories.
Well, the storytelling is amazing, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I know that we're almost out of time, but I have one final question for you.
Yeah.
I listened to your virtual event with Chris Jackson earlier this year, and
I loved him so much.
Which feels like months ago. It's crazy. But he asked you if you still feel hopeful for the future, and you said that you did. I'm wondering if that's still true, and kind of, and how you're finding hope in the world as we're nearing this upcoming election.
Oh yeah, I'm hopeful. And it's not a fake hope. Look, I say this in the book, hope is not the absence of despair. I feel devastated and I also feel hopeful at the same time. What I know is that this way of life is dying. It is no longer serving us, and that is becoming apparent to more and more people. And not only that, but the way I know when something is dying, it's like it functions kind of like a wounded animal, right? Like it strikes when you try to like give it care. This way of life is done. And so the question for us now is, how do we give hospice care to that which is dying away and that which needs to die away? And then how do we provide prenatal care to the things that we need to birth and the things that need to be born in order for us to live better together? And that place is where I spend most of my time. And so at the same time that I'm like devastated about the state of the world, I mean, this morning I was reading up all about the NSARS movement in Nigeria, and just like, you know, I mean, these problems are not unique to the United States and the people who are being murdered right now for protesting, right? And that kind of anger fuels me into thinking about what else can we build instead. So that's what I'm sitting with most days. And that's where my spirit goes. It's like, okay, how do we change it? How do we fix it? And I also know, as somebody who's been doing this work for a long time, that some change is really fast and other change is really slow. And you never know which one is going to be which. So you always prepare for both. And so I'm preparing for both, knowing that the people who came before me also dealt with really terrible stuff, like really, really awful shit that people didn't think they were going to survive. And some people did not, but some people did. And so there is hope in them. And so, yes, I am still hopeful.
Well, that was a beautiful answer. And your book gave me a huge sense of hope. I feel like I learned so much and I'm so inspired. And thank you so much for taking the time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for publishing my book, Random House. Yay!
And now, here's an exclusive excerpt from the audiobook, courtesy of Penguin Random House Audio.
7 years ago, I started the Black Lives Matter Global Network with my sisters Patrice Cullors and Opal Tometi. BLM went from a hashtag to a series of pages on social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter to a global network. The movement has generated the highest number of protests since the last major period of civil rights. When I started writing this book, that's what I thought it would be about: the story of Black Lives Matter, its origin, and most profound lessons. The funny thing is, when I sat down to write, that's not what came out. The first paragraphs were about my mother and how she trained my eyes to see the world. The opening words turned into a story about my own personal journey, words about lessons I've learned from more than 20 years of organizing and building movements, words that I know I wanted and needed to read when I started doing this work so many years ago, words that, honestly, I need right now. It's my deepest wish that the words that follow are the ones you need to hear right now, too. Even though I'd been an organizer for more than 10 years when Black Lives Matter began, it was the first time I'd been part of something that garnered so much attention. Being catapulted from a local organizer who worked in national coalitions to the international spotlight was unexpected. The OGs in my life would probably say that Black Lives Matter grew me up, but that's not quite true. My experience with BLM toughened my skin and softened my heart. It confirmed things I knew but couldn't express, clarified and sharpened my values, and taught me how to recommit to work that broke my heart every day. BLM accelerated my education in movement building, but it was the decade of organizing prior to Black Lives Matter that grew me up. My parents used to run an antiques business, so I grew up learning about history through people and the objects they made. For instance, my favorite type of porcelain is a type of Satsuma ware, which has a unique glaze that makes the surface appear to be broken into millions of small pieces. The intention behind the glaze is to make the colors appear deeper and more vibrant, but it also makes the porcelain look old, a trait that implies elegance and aristocracy. As a kid, I found Satsuma porcelain beautiful because it looked like broken pieces that had fused together to make something new. I like to imagine what other lives those shards of pottery might have had if they had been put back together as something else, or what future lives awaited them. A jewelry box? A tea kettle? A dish? What might they become next? This book is the story of an organizer who comes apart and is put back together many, many times. The words contained within it, the stories that they form, are intended to add richness and depth to that larger story. It is not the story of Black Lives Matter, but it is a story that includes it, that attempts to make sense of not only where it came from, but also the possibilities that it and movements like it hold for our collective future. More than that, this book is meant to offer listeners the lessons I've learned along the way, the things I'm still learning, and what my learning may contribute in a time of profound catastrophe and limitless possibility. A time when we desperately need waves of vibrant, effective, and disruptive movements to flow all across America. I've been asked many times over the years what an ordinary person can do to build a movement from a hashtag. Though I know the question generally comes from an earnest place, I still cringe every time I am asked it. You cannot start a movement from a hashtag. Hashtags do not start movements, people do. Movements do not have official moments when they start and end, and there is never just one person who initiates them. Movements are much more like waves than they are like light switches. Waves ebb and flow, but they are perpetual. Their starting point unknown, their ending point undetermined, their direction dependent upon the conditions that surround them and the barriers that obstruct them. We inherit movements. We recommit to them over and over again, even when they break our hearts, because they are essential to our survival.
Thank you for listening to Books Connect Us. For more great book recommendations and information about your favorite authors, feel free to follow Penguin Random House on social media or visit penguinrandomhouse.com. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, go ahead and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, as it helps more listeners to find our show. This podcast is produced by Pat Stango and edited by Clayton Gumbert. I've been Erin Leaf, and until next time, this has been Books Connect Us.